morning. How are you? What? You've just had Christmas and then snow. It's been brilliant. You should be really happy. And then you read this really scary novel that told you shouldn't trust your aunties and uncles. Isn't that just brilliant? Okay, hello everyone. I'm going to be lecturing for 4 weeks. You're lucky people. My lectures on Angela Carter go on for 4 weeks, so this is not everything I have to say about this novel. When I lecture next week, I'm going to talk about, as planned, De Beauvoir and Cixous, but in relation to Carter. So every week, we will have a different reading of the novel, so that at the end of 4 weeks, you will have 5 different interpretations of the text. That's the point of this module. It's about ways of reading, modes of reading texts. Before I start the lecture, I have a couple of announcements for you. You know your essay is due in when? Yay, on Monday. I hope it'll be ready by Friday, obviously, edited, ready to be submitted. Don't forget e-submission. The deadline for e-submission is 2 o'clock. You have to submit your essays electronically by 2 p.m. Please do not miss this deadline and then send me emails because it's very time consuming to deal with this. 2 o'clock. 2 copies of the essay have to be submitted to the office by 3 o'clock with 1 cover sheet. There's instructions, very detailed instructions on how to do this that I posted on the forum at the end of last term. There's also instructions on how to do this on the departmental website. And if you don't know how to submit essays, ask your seminar tutor. The second announcement is about my office hours. My office hours for this term are on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock, on Wednesdays at 9 a.m., and Thursdays after the lecture. If you would like to see me on Fridays, unfortunately, this term I teach a lot on Fridays, but if you'd like to email me, I'll try and find a time to see you on Friday. Okay, here we go. Now, in the first lecture for this, in the very first lecture on this module in week 1, term 1, if you remember, I spoke about concepts that we borrow from de Saussure and Freud to read and interpret literary texts. I also gave you a list of 6 critical questions and invited you to use them while you read the fiction and literary criticism that we've assigned. At the start of this term, I want to remind you that everything we learned in term 1 is, of course, still useful. The concepts that Pablo and Rashmi presented are tools for reading, which you should practice on this module, on literature in the modern world, and on your honors level modules. That's what we're doing in this course. We are teaching you how to read. And all of these theories you're going to need to use in your honors level modules. So in the 4 lectures that constitute this unit, I'm going to be tackling ideas by some of what I think are the most inspiring, the most challenging, and possibly some of the most difficult critics you have yet to read. As you will have noticed, we've doubled the assignment of theory extracts, so you're doing twice as much reading. You're doing this because we feel that now you're comfortable enough to do much more theory and know how to use it. What I want to start off by doing today is a little bit of chronology, because so far on the module, we haven't been teaching these texts chronologically. And at the start of this unit, I want to give you a little understanding of the historical context for Magic Toy Shop, Ginsberg's Howl, and of course I'm going to mention Colin McInnes's Absolute Beginners, but only for 1 paragraph. Don't have nightmares. Here we go. This is the chronology. You'll notice we haven't been reading these chronologically on purpose. Howl, which is the last text we're going to read this year, was published in 1955. And then it's Absolute Beginners, 1959, Magic Toy Shop in 67, and Buddha of Suburbia in 1990. So, I wonder what the people at home will make of this noise. So, I'm going to do context by starting in 1950. When I read Absolute Beginners, when I read Magic Toy Shop, when I read Howl, there are 2 momentous events in history that I keep in mind. Of course, the end of World War II in 1945, and specifically when I read Magic Toy Shop, I think about the situation of the women's movement in Britain in the 60s and 70s. The second historical event I'll talk about next week. So the historical context I'm offering you today is post-1945, the 1950s and 60s. By 1950, the years of scarcity that immediately followed World War II were coming to an end, and a period of economic growth and relative political stability had begun. And this period of economic growth was going to last until the worldwide recession of 1970. What's interesting, though, is in spite of this economic growth and political stability, much of the literature from the 1950s fails to reflect the optimism that one might expect under such circumstances. You know, in 1955, Britain boasted full employment, a fantastic welfare state system, and high standards of living. And while the newspapers, while politicians announced the advent of a class-free society with enough resources for everyone, English novelists did not engage in this optimism. Look at this, just a cover from one of the newspapers in 1945. We did it, lots of optimism, it's the end of the war. There's, you know, oh, victory, yay, well done. And then here we are, everybody celebrating in London. There's a very strong mood of optimism and joy at the end of the war. But the fiction does not reflect that. The emergence in the 1950s of, I'm sure you know, the angry young men, of these playwrights and novelists who became known collectively as the angry young men, might be read as a sign of this new class mobility. English novelists tapped into a darker vein of disillusionment, disorientation, and in some cases, they expressed some nostalgia for the days when the English knew where they stood, and both in a domestic class system and in international relations. I don't expect you to know all the references that I'm mentioning here, but this is just to give you an idea of the context in which Magic Toy Shop appears in 1967. The angry young men were writers mostly of lower class origin who were concerned with their political and economic aspirations. And they were not necessarily a coherent group, so you would find left-wing and right-wing writers among them. They included, of course, John Osborne, whose wonderful, I think, play, Look Back in Anger, is the Angry's text. And of course, Harold Pinter and Alan Sillitoe. The angry young men were disillusioned with traditional English values and challenged tradition. And their emergence, as I said, could be read as the sign of a new class mobility, of an openness to new voices. And here is where Colin McInnes's Absolute Beginners fits in 1959. Absolute Beginners, as we have seen, helped to create a presence in the reading public's imagination for a new socioeconomic group, and that's the youth. We've already discussed the rise of real wages, we've already discussed the lifestyle of teenagers who could earn a lot of money by the age of 21. Young people who had experienced a childhood of war and rationing now had money for leisure spending, and that created a youth culture which the likes of which had never previously existed. And so instead of having novels that evoked so much of the pleasures of increased consumption, that evoke the pleasures of television-fueled dreams, instead you get novels that talk about disenfranchisement and alienation among young people. And of course, I'm thinking here of other texts that kind of reflect this mood of pessimism and disillusionment with the state, texts like A Clockwork Orange and Lord of the Flies. I'm not going to dwell much on these texts because I'm not sure if you have read them, but one of the characteristics, of course, of Clockwork Orange is that Anthony Burgess created for his narrator a hybrid language. And language is going to become very important when we talk about Angela Carter's novel. And in this hybrid novel, hybrid language in the novel, he made the language sound like slang, but it also sounded like Russianized English. And he did this because he was evoking a familiar world that is rendered menacing. It's rendered menacingly alien because he was commenting on the effect of the Cold War. He was commenting on this state of England that has become like a crumbling totalitarian state. So the language of the novel is expressing disillusionment with society. And this I'm going to relate to Angela Carter's novel in a moment when I think about the kind of language that she's using. So such bleak visions may have contributed to the feeling on the part of many readers and writers alike that by 1960, English fiction suffered from a profound lack of vitality. There was widespread uncertainty about where England was going, and this may have translated into uncertainty about the direction of the English novel, and perhaps a certain skepticism toward the new, which was applied not only to content but to form. That's why we see so much, we see different approaches to narrative strategies, some that are highly innovative, like Angela Carter, and some that are highly conservative. Okay. Many of the novelists who rose to prominence in the 1960s, and here I'm citing novelists that I think would have influenced Angela Carter specifically. I'm citing Iris Murdoch, John Fowles, and Doris Lessing. Many of these novels combine realism with some degree of psychological experimentation, but they do so in the service of social criticism. And this is where I want to locate Carter's work. I read her as combining realism with fantasy, with psychological experimentation, realism, fantasy, and psychological experimentation, and all in the service of social criticism. I know that this is a contentious point, and next week I'm going to show you some critics who would disagree with this idea. But for this reading for today, I'm going to argue that the combination of realism, fantasy, and psychological experimentation is done for the purpose of social criticism. And in her rather short writing career, Carter engaged with modernist ideas, of course, but also, I would argue, that she took part in ushering in postmodernism from the 1960s onwards. So Angela Carter's novels from the late 60s to the late 80s, please don't feel that you have to write down everything you see on the slides. You know that I will publish this PowerPoint presentation on the website. The reason I have these slides is for you just to see the words on the paper and because I'm going to do close analysis in a moment. Angela Carter's novels from the 60s to the late 1980s mingle the fantastic with the insistently political. And she uses richly artificial language filled with intertextual references. And by doing so, Carter's novels both critique and expand the existing range of social imagery. I know this is a very dense statement. This is my premise for today. The rest of the lecture is going to decode my premise. So that's what I'm going to do today. My premise for today's lecture is this, and I'm going to read it again. I'm going to decode it. Carter's novels mingle the fantastic with the political, using richly artificial language filled with intertextual references. And by doing so, Carter's novels both critique and expand the existing range of social imagery. Now I'm going to develop this statement. If you have your books, I'm going to read various bits from the books you might want to follow from your text. I'm going to read two paragraphs from page 2 of the text. And while I read, I'm going to illustrate the range of images that Carter evoked. Okay. Page 2 of the novel. This is Melanie at the start of the novel, naked in her room, staring at herself in the mirror, as young girls obviously do, and this is what Carter writes. She also posed in attitudes, holding things. Right? Pre-Raphaelite, she combed out her long black hair to stream straight down from a center parting, and thoughtfully regarded herself as she held a tiger lily from the garden under her chin, her knees pressed together. À la Toulouse-Lautrec, she dragged her hair sluttishly across her face and sat down in a chair with her legs apart and a bowl of water and a towel at her feet. She always felt particularly wicked when she posed for Lautrec, although she made up fantasies in which she lived in his time. In these fantasies, she helped him and loved him because she was sorry for him, since he was a dwarf and a genius. She was too thin for a Titien or a Renoir, but she contrived a pale, smug Cranach Venus with a bit of net curtain wound round her head and the necklace of cultured pearls they gave her when she was confirmed at her throat. After she read Lady Chatterley's Lover, she secretly picked forget-me-nots and stuck them in her pubic hair, as you do. Of course, the next thing that she does, this has nothing to do with now, but I didn't want to leave the naked woman, so because I didn't want to distract you. So I'll get to Lorna Doone in a minute. Of course, the next thing she does after she poses and imagines herself and, you know, being painted by various people, the next thing she does is dream of her phantom bridegroom and design her wedding dress and think about her honeymoon. Well, I'm arguing that Carter's novels both critique and expand the existing range of social imagery, especially that imagery available to women in the late 1960s. The reader in this passage that I've just read witnesses a young girl's process of socialization, which is mediated not by her mother, as the norm would dictate, and not by her nanny, which is what her social class would dictate. But the process of socialization that we witness in this passage is mediated by the range of visual representations of femininity which Melanie draws from the Western, from Western art and Western literature. Remember the opening lines of this novel. The summer she was 15, Melanie discovered that she was made of flesh and blood. This opening line introduces the theme of self-discovery and self-definition in which Melanie is engaged. The discovery of the desire of self-induced pleasure is a personal revelation to Melanie. In her state of excitement, as she understands the physical possibilities of her body, Melanie then needs an objective correlative to her ideas and feelings. This is the Dictionary of Literary Terms that you own, yeah? This is a quote taken from it. Do you know the concept of objective correlative? This means yes, this means no. Brilliant, now I can teach you something new. Okay, we borrow this term from T.S. Eliot, who wrote that the only way of expressing emotion in the form of art is by finding an objective correlative. In other words, a set of objects, situations, a chain of events, which shall be the formula of that particular emotion, such that when the external facts, which must terminate in sensory experience, are given, the emotion is immediately evoked. Yeah? It's all right, I'm going to do more on this. So I'm going to explain it. In her state of excitement, as she understands the physical possibilities of her body, Melanie needs an objective correlative to her ideas, to her feelings. Once the physical sensations have subsided, she continues her feelings of elation by conjuring from memory the various images of women's bodies that she has acquired through her education into Western modes of representation. So these images serve as an objective correlative to her emotions. I'm doing this now because later on in the novel, I'm going to show you how these same images resurface later on. But she redefines their meaning. Let's look at these images again. What do they look like? We've got the Pre-Raphaelites, we've got Toulouse-Lautrec, we've got Cranach, we've got Lady Chatterley's lover, we've got Lorna Doone. Melanie's ideas of her body and what it is meant for, what it can do, what it is supposed to do, are mediated through the visual images and the literary texts she has absorbed. They become objective correlatives. So my first interpretation of this passage is that the references here serve to demonstrate the socialization process that Melanie is involved in the absence of a mother figure. What does this process look like? Well, it's clear at the start of the novel that Melanie is sexualizing her body, but she's also seeing herself as a carer. For example, she says, oh, she wished she could look after Toulouse-Lautrec because he was a dwarf and a genius. But she also imagines herself as a wife. She plans her wedding and her honeymoon. So she is a sexual being, she is a carer, and she is a wife. Now, my premise here is that Carter's novels are critiquing and expanding the existing range of social imagery that was available to women in the late 1960s. The critique of the range of social imagery is for us to decipher. That's what I'm doing now. Carter's text examines the roles available to young girls, to women, and delineates them into a story that is set in 1969 to see what can be accomplished in such settings. So Carter's text is saying, let's play with these roles. Let's look at what a middle-class education can do to a girl. Let's see what it is like to be a housewife. And of course, Carter's style is not straightforwardly realist. Instead, she's using magic, fantasy, myth, and legend to show absurdity at times, but also to emphasize the eternal nature of the struggles that she's representing, because she's linking them to myth, legend, and fairy tale. Thanks for nodding. Okay. In one of her later novels, The Passion of New Eve, it's a brilliant novel. It's so much fun to read. You don't want to give it to your mum, but you want to read it because it's superb. So, Easter reading list. In one of her later novels, The Passion of New Eve, Carter's narrator says, our external symbols must always express the life within us with absolute precision. The nature of our life alone has determined their forms. A critique of these symbols is a critique of our lives. So by creating external symbols drawn from literature and fantasy to represent Melanie's internal life, and then by positioning Melanie in a setup where these symbols do not empower her, that's her uncle's house. She creates the symbols, then she puts Melanie in a setup where these symbols don't serve her, don't empower her. Carter is critiquing society's own established codes of representation. Does this make sense? Okay. When Melanie moves to her uncle's house, the shift in her lifestyle is not only centered around wealth and class. By moving to her uncle's house, Melanie is transposed from the safe world of dreams to a harsh world of reality. So if the only roles she knows how to play are those of the coded mannequin, and I'm going to talk about this term in another lecture, the only roles she knows how to play are those of the coded mannequin that her education has provided, then, of course, the metaphor of the puppet in a toy shop is the ideal one to represent her. And this leads me to think about the contextual significance of Carter's ideas. Carter wrote about the late 1960s that this was a time when we were truly asking ourselves questions about the nature of reality. And she says, I can date to that time, to the late 1960s, and to that sense of heightened awareness of the society around me in the summer of 1968, my own questioning of the nature of my reality as a woman. How that social fiction of my femininity was created. You see her words, the social fiction of my quote-unquote femininity was created by means outside my control and palmed off on me as the real thing. This investigation of the social fictions that regulate our lives, what Blake called the mind-forged manacles, is what I've concerned myself with consciously since that time. Do you see what this quote is saying? It's a very powerful statement that Carter is making about the socialization that young girls went through. It's actually a quote that I'll explore further next week in the lecture on De Beauvoir and Cixous. But Carter is saying that the 1960s were a time when the nature of reality was being questioned, the nature of what is real, what is imaginary, what is possible, and what has been forbidden. This book belongs to that time when Carter was asking questions about the nature of my reality as a woman. Are the images of femininity that have been imposed on me real? Are they constructed? Are they true? When I'm reading about women who can only play the roles of the sexy model, the virgin mother, the obedient wife, when I read and see these images, and when I'm told that this is my reality, these are my options, Carter is saying that I should question that. I should investigate the social fictions that regulate my life, the mind-forged manacles, the chains that stop me from experimenting with my body and with my femininity. Now, to illustrate the extent to which the context in which Melanie's story is repressive, Carter places her in her uncle's house in London. What kind of house is it, and what does it represent? Carter depicts the house using a combination of highly symbolic codes from fantasy, fairy tale, legend, and the myths that construct our civilization. The setting, as you have noticed, I'm sure, is undoubtedly Gothic. It displays a conspicuous eroticism. It depicts eccentric characters, archetypes, sadists. This is all Gothic. And here I want to use one of her own descriptions to explain Gothic setting, to explain the Gothic setting she creates. In an afterword to her collection of stories, Fireworks, Carter wrote about her early admiration for Edgar Allan Poe and her affinity for the Gothic. And this is her own understanding of what Gothic is and does. The Gothic tradition in which Poe writes grandly ignores the value systems of our institutions. It deals entirely with the profane. Its great themes are incest and cannibalism. Character and events are exaggerated beyond reality to become symbols, ideas, passions. Its style will tend to be ornate, unnatural, and thus operate against the perennial desire to believe the word as fact. Its only humor is black humor. It retains a singular moral function, that of provoking unease. Well, this could be a fair description of Carter's own work. Incest is a recurrent theme, and even her most realistic stories have dark undercurrents of violence and perverse eroticism, especially sadomasochism, sometimes accompanied by a reversal of roles, which is what we see in Magic Toy Shop. And of course, a major aim of her fiction is to provoke unease. The unease comes from the blurring of the distinctions between conscious and unconscious. I'm going to show you an example of that in a minute. The contemporary and the archaic, civilized and the savage, adult and child, the masculine and the feminine, and of course the innocent and the erotic. She blurs the boundaries between these distinctions. In this novel, the uncle's house is a strange household in which mirrors are forbidden. This is a house where her aunt has been struck dumb and where Melanie is a virtual prisoner. It's a nightmarish atmosphere compounded with guilt, with incest, rape that envelops the characters. More importantly, this is a story that is compelled by fear. There is fear at every turn. Fear of the uncle, fear of the cousins, fear of the puppets. Look at page 84, for example. Carter writes that Melanie was a wind-up, putting-away doll, clicking through its programmed movements. Uncle Philip might have made her over already. She was without volition of her own. She was in limbo and would be for the rest of her life. In this state of limbo, Melanie decides to become a spectator of her life because she doesn't have the tools to deal with her life at the moment. So she uses, alternatively, the metaphors of the cinema and of fairy tales to read the reality around her. In the same scene on page 84, she imagines Uncle Philip as a character in a film, possibly played by Orson Welles. She was sitting in a cinema watching the film. Later on, Carter describes one morning when Melanie was walking from her room to the kitchen. I like this one. She felt lonely and chilled, walking along the long brown passages past secret doors shut tight, Bluebeard's castle. Melanie felt a shudder of dread as she went by every door, in case it opened and something, some clockwork horror, rolling hugely on small wheels, some terrifying joke or hideous novelty, emerged to put her courage to the test. Her sense of fear and her reading of the surroundings through a Gothic perspective emphasized her sense of alienation and built tension in the novel. Tension between imagination and reality. Who occupied the rooms in the daytime? Bluebeard's castle it was, or Mr. Fox's manor house with be bold, but not too bold, written up over every lintel and chopped up corpses neatly piled in all the wardrobes and airing cupboards on top of the sheets and pillow slips. And in the state of like real heightened kind of tension, she looks like a nervous wreck, ready to scream at any moment. She sees the dog. Just a tiny little dog sitting at the top of the stairs, but no. She sees the dog at the top of the stairs, and she likens it to Moby Dick, the great big white whale. Marvelous. She thinks she's trapped by this little dog. She thinks she's trapped by it. She thinks it's going to snap off her leg as she walks past. And Melanie wonders, and this is free indirect discourse, she wonders and says, which dog is it? The real one or the painted one? Just a moment out of nowhere. So this is all in her imagination, and she knows it. In the next paragraph, she reaches the kitchen, and what does she see? Aunt Margaret peeling potatoes in a plastic bowl with water on her knees. A banal, uninteresting reality, yet nonetheless threatening. Do you remember the scene? Did you skip it when you were reading? It's a very good scene. What can we make of this textual imagery? Well, Carter herself was quoted saying, "We live in Gothic times." This diagnosis is repeated throughout her work, where the bizarre, the grotesque, and the fantastic are presented as the everyday, as the commonplace, and the commonplace is seen as menacing. As we've just seen, by doing this, Carter attempts to demythologize Western culture, to expose its strangeness, masquerading as the natural or the real. Do you see what I'm saying? She's inviting us to question what we see as real, what we see as threatening, and what we perceive as safe, as homely, as comfortable. Yes? Great. Okay, now another interpretation. So we're going to look at this paragraph again, and this time from a different perspective. And actually, if you take a quick read through the first 60 pages of this novel, you notice a wider range of intertextual references. And now I'm going to use the word intertextuality, not just references, and I'm going to talk about it. For example, we've got Victoria, little Victoria, likened to Mrs. Rochester on page 8. Then we've got references to Romeo and Juliet, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Pilgrim's Progress, Lorna Doone, The Light of the World, there it is, the painting by William Hunt, La Belle au Bois Dormant, Fairy Tale. It's my favorite picture. It's from my own childhood book. This is what my mom told me princesses do. We sleep and we wait patiently for hundreds of years. And then, of course, there's references. This is how Melanie's growing up. That's what she's reading. And, of course, there's also references to Last Meal in the Old Home, the painting. So the first aspect of what I've just said has to do with intertextuality. And I want to pause and think about this term so you know how to use it and you don't confuse it with allusion. We have a definition of intertextuality in the Dictionary of Literary Terms. The term intertextuality was coined by the French critic, Julia Kristeva, in 1966. And she uses this term to refer to the ways in which literary texts depend on each other. She claims that literary texts are interdependent, meaning that any one literary text depends on all those texts that were written before it to create its range of references, its imagery, etc. But be careful not to confuse it with allusion. Yeah? Here it is. Intertextuality is different from allusion. Allusion merely gestures towards another text without taking on its entire context. But intertextuality refers to Kristeva's observation that a literary text is made up of a mosaic of quotations, and that any text is the absorption and transformation of another. You see those two really important terms, absorption and transformation, not merely name-dropping, not merely gesturing towards another text. Kristeva calls the stance, the position from which I'm speaking, the thetic. This is the only technical term I'm going to give you. It's an important technical term. She calls the stance of the speaker the thetic. Intertextuality in a text happens when we witness a new articulation of the thetic. So that means when the stance of the speaker is significantly altered, is significantly changed through transposition. We have so far seen Melanie take a particular position with regards to the images she absorbs through her reading, right? She's just absorbing these images and seeing herself part of these fairy tales and myths. We start talking about intertextuality when the position of the speaker, the stance of the speaker, changes vis-a-vis these images. And that's what I'm going to show you now, how her position towards these images changes, alters. And the position changes because the speaker has experienced these references, not just read about them. Because the speaker has created a new signifying system for these references. Can you see where I'm going with this? Oh, thank you. Okay, you'll see in a moment. So when Melanie leaves her parents' house, she experiences a period of transition. You see, the way I read this text is that there's parents' house, lots of images, lots of moments of, you know, unhappiness, basically, and happiness. Period of transition, real bulk middle of the novel. And then last part of the novel, a revision of the first period. This revision is the intertextual bit, is the bit where the thetic, the stance of the speaker changes. So when she leaves her parents' house, moves to her uncle's house, there's a period of transition. She feels, like I showed you before, that she is in a state of limbo and would be for the rest of her life. She experiences nostalgia for her parents' home. We are told that she ached with longing. And during this period of transition, Melanie tries to interpret what is happening to her using the range of references she's brought with her from her other life. Look at this scene here. It was the fault of the wedding dress night, she says to herself, when she married the shadows and the world ended. All this was taking place. Everything that's happening to her now was taking place in an empty space at the end of the world. Well, what does this mean? Why does she feel like this? Melanie's past has created a range of references which are not compatible with her current reality. All this that is taking place around her, and that means the red people flirting with each other, Uncle Philip, an ogre and a monster, the fact that they drink tea way too much and no coffee, the fact that they wear old clothes, the fact that they don't wash and have no lavatory paper, all this, she says, was disgusting. It doesn't make sense to her. It is happening in an empty space. It's not the space of the real that she knew in her parents' house. On the one hand, Melanie finds herself unable to explain the world around her. But on the other hand, she repeatedly notes that in spite of all that, they were red and had substance. And she, Melanie, was forever gray, a shadow. This is the crucial moment in the narrative. Melanie realizes that the red people are there, are real. Her range of references is not. It's borrowed, it's artificial. It belongs to a different time, a different context. Her range of references is fantasy. And as long as she lives with those images, she will be a shadow. In one touching scene, she laments her innocence. On page 92, she says, "If only I wasn't so young and inexperienced and dependent." This again is another scene using free indirect discourse. So what does she do next? Here she is, stuck in limbo, doesn't know what's going on around her, the real doesn't seem real, fantasy is not helpful. Well, she invents herself. She creates an identity. So far, she's been living on borrowed images. And these images are useless here. She needs to appropriate them. What does she do? This is the passage that I read at the beginning of the lecture. In this passage, you notice that she was posing for painters, fictional painters, Toulouse-Lautrec, Titien, Renoir, etc. What does she do now? She knows that Finn looks through the spy hole, spies on her. She poses for him. She actually enacts the posing that she was imagining. She poses for Finn, and she knows that he paints her. And then, of course, she finds the painting. So instead of imagining herself transposed into other painters' paintings, she finds her own painting in his room. She saw herself and was touched. This is when she's looking at the painting that Finn has done of her. She was taking off her chocolate sweater and was all twisted up, a rather thin but nicely made young girl with a delicate withdrawn face against a wall of dark roses. What is that wall? Her wallpaper. Here she is painted in her context, in her own room, with her own background. Her black hair exploded about her head in a great Art Nouveau ripples. Notice how scenes from the beginning of the novel are revised and take on a different meaning. For example, on page 208, when Melanie walks into Aunt Margaret's room to give her the green dress, she sees the photo of her mother's wedding on the dressing table. The same photo she had seen in her parents' home the day before the night when she went into the garden and wore the wedding dress and disaster happened. The sight of this photo now has to be reconsidered in this context. The sight of this photo disturbs her, not because she sees her parents, but because she feels it's a bad omen. This has all happened before. And indeed, she was right. The sight of the photo is followed by Melanie's gift of the green dress to her aunt, Margaret. And then, of course, she gives her the cultured pearls. This scene, like the one before it, anticipates violence, leading to death and destruction. This time, though, Melanie is watching. Melanie is watching the events, and she's orchestrating the ensuing violence. Melanie helped her aunt like a lady's maid, setting the dress and adjusting the hang of the skirt and zipping up the back. Her aunt stood stock still and let Melanie dress her. She looked beatified. Melanie then steps back, looks at her aunt, and her first thought is, am I as thin as that? Can you see how she's now reenacting these traumas to see what different meaning they can have? She's orchestrating this scene. She's seeing herself again on that night when everything changed. And of course, you know that after this scene, this is the scene when Aunt Margaret looks really pretty, gets down to the kitchen and gets down to it, basically, and then trauma happens. So the intertextuality happens when the narrative appropriates the images and contextualizes them for Melanie. When Melanie creates the circumstances of her own real portrait, which is in the spirit of Toulouse-Lautrec, when Melanie looks after the wounded, drunk Finn who comes to her bed, lonely, in the spirit of a Toulouse-Lautrec that needs looking after because he's a dwarf and a genius. When Melanie's ominous experience in the garden of her parents' house is repeated, this time for the benefit of her aunt, it is as if Melanie has learned to appropriate external references to make them work for her. Okay, so my thesis statement was that Carter's novels mingle the fantastic with the politically rich, using language filled with intertextual references. And by doing so, Carter's novels critique and expand the existing range of social imagery. And what I've done in this lecture is show you how Carter uses intertextuality to demonstrate that the process of maturing must involve a rethinking of the images that society presents us with as fixed, desirable, as static representations of ourselves. Carter's strategy involves a blurring of the boundaries between the fantastical and the real in order to emphasize that the real should not be limited to what is available, that we can create our own reality by questioning the myths that have been imposed on us. If this novel was written at a time when social anxieties about England's position in the world and about the state of Englishness, this novel was written at a time when social hierarchies were being eroded, then this novel has told us a great deal about the implications of growing up as a young, middle-class girl in the 1960s. What I haven't covered today, and which I will cover in the following lectures, is the tension between Uncle Philip, why he hates Melanie's father, what Melanie's father represents, and the political tension between those two families. So next week, I'm going to carry on talking about myths that surround us. I'm going to do De Beauvoir and Cixous. See you then. Was this okay? Yes? Good. See you next week.